You're tuned to 1520 WCHE Radio, and it's time now for the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will offer reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today, and now Sam Hankin.
Just remember to yell.
Okay, I will. All right, I will. Okay, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop, which is my bookshop and nobody else's. Plus, we just won the best bookstore in Philadelphia, which is really cool, and we also won somewhat more arcanely and eclectically the best non-corporate coffee shop on the main line, which I don't know what that means, but people come into the store asking what it means, which means they're inside the store, so that's good. But enough about me. Today we are lucky enough to have with us the formerly mysterious Nell Zink, who is author of The Wall Creeper, which sounds like it might be a perfect Halloween book, but it's not, because a wall creeper is a bird, a strange bird, and a wonderful bird. And this book is a lot about birding and sex, or as Nell's characters proclaim from time to time in debate, breeding and feeding, which seems logical to me. Anyway, Nell used to write her novels to one person because that was the person she wanted to read them. But then she wrote one to Jonathan Franzen, this book, who's a birder, and so we're happy to see that now her book, which was published by Dorothy, a publishing project, a great publishing house, that we can all read her book. And the other thing that's cool is the book is small enough that you could put in your back pocket if you had a very large back pocket. And it was published this October. Anyway, The Wall Creeper is a novel like none you will ever read. I don't even know, actually, if it's a novel. And even the reviews are strange. Keith Gesson says he hopes that Don DeLillo doesn't kill Nell Zink. So thanks, Nell, for being here and talking to me.
Thanks for having me.
So have you ever thought about the fact that, well, I'm sure you have, that your last name is an element, you know, that you're zinc?
I figured that out at an early age, when the periodic table used to play a more central role in my life.
Likewise. But the thing about zinc is you like mercury a lot because you talk about mercury in the book, and I love mercury. And you're on the same column as mercury, and you're only separated by cadmium.
Now, this is news to me because I have basically repressed all memory of the periodic table, and I sort of remember what the noble gases might be.
Ooh.
And I know it's really interesting, and I read the book by Primo Levi.
Yeah, me too.
Barking, that's Cha-Cha.
Is that your uncle? Is that your uncle barking?
No, that's his Maltese Cha-Cha.
I remember the inert gases, noble gases. Can you name them? I can.
I think one of them might be argon.
Helium, argon, neon, krypton, xenon.
My uncle's nodding.
Radon.
Krypton?
Yeah, the planet.
Krypton is a real thing?
Yeah, it's a noble gas.
Oh, man.
I had some.
You see how out of touch I am?
Well, you can't be out of touch with the elements, really.
I'm so out of touch with 8th grade, or 9th grade, or whatever it was.
Well, so anyway,
actually,
I just...
it might have been 11th, but it's all a blur.
Zinc is kind of like, I hate to say this, but kind of a worthless element. Not worthless.
That is so not true. It's a key element in sunscreen.
Well, yeah, zinc ointment. Do you want to go around looking like a lifeguard with zinc ointment on your nose? No. But all your pennies are made of zinc. But they still cost more than a penny to make.
I have a strong suspicion that it's only the ointments that make you look white that actually work without involving those nanoparticles, and we know about them. So.
Well, supposedly they have zinc ointment now that's clear, but I don't believe that. I think it's a lie.
But yet it probably involves nanoparticles, like little tiny zinc. But I do not want to talk about health issues because this is pushing me into a very cliché corner for female writers where I do not want to go.
Cliché corner for female writers is health?
Yeah, the next thing we'll be talking about high colonic enemas.
I wouldn't preclude
my wheat allergy.
I wouldn't preclude high colonic enemas from one of your books at this point after having read this one.
I think I can say to you with confidence that no such procedure will ever take place in one of my books.
So
ever, as long as I live.
Well, okay.
And not even in my posthumous material.
Well, I bet you...
Well, let's change the subject quickly before anybody starts listening.
No one's going to listen
to
this.
We probably got their attention with that. Like, you probably lulled them to sleep with the zinc.
The high colonic will get most people's attention. It will certainly get mine
next time. Say it again a couple times.
All right, I'm going to stop. Okay, I won't do that anymore.
Okay.
But, right. Okay, I like epigraphs, and your epigraph is from a guy I hate, Ted Hughes. I hate all poet laureates because it means they're lousy poets. But... It's this guy, the idea that Wait a minute. I don't have it with me. What does it say exactly? The one line.
It says, I kill where I please because it is all mine.
Well, yeah, so he killed his two wives.
Oh, man. You are so ill-informed.
He did kill them. And he killed his wife was a better poet than him, and Colossus was way better than anything he ever wrote.
That is so not true. Read some Sylvia Plath and then read some Ted Hughes, and your eyes will be opened. This epigraph is from a very wonderful poem.
I read it.
Early poems called Hawk Roosting. I can't recite it, but it's really very, very well done. And Sylvia Plath was loosely wound from a tender age.
Well, I mean, she wrote The Bell Jar. I understand that. But she did put her head in the oven, but at least she took care of her kids and put the carpet under the door. But his second wife also put her head in the oven, and she put her two kids' heads in the oven with her. So, I mean, how often does that happen with two marriages?
I think you're blaming the victim when you say this is Ted's fault. I know, I have not met the guy. I'm not saying he's a great guy.
Well, he's dead now.
I don't think he's a bad poet. Not one bit. His material he did as poet laureate, of course, is embarrassing and
and
horrifying. But that happens to anyone, I think, who's put in the position of having to write about the Queen's birthday.
Well, it also happens
when better. Trust me.
When Maya Angelou reads that poem at the inauguration of Bill Clinton, it also happens. But anyway,
it made you shudder, right?
Oh yeah, God, it was horrible, especially that last Good Morning. Jeez, that sucked. Anyway, so did you like being a bricklayer?
No. It was hard for me. It was hard physical labor, which I'm not really built for. I had to be a bricklayer because I couldn't even really lift a cinder block, not enough to control where it was going when I put it back down. This was really a mismatch as a career choice.
Well,
so I got out of that as soon as I could. It took a while. But
I like stuff like that, and I like laying sod because it's just green side up, and it's short-term goal, and it's kind of meditation.
Well, my favorite job as a bricklayer was doing paving because I didn't have to lift the bricks. I just had to arrange them on the ground, and people will pay a lot for it. People will be like, they have a party planned on Sunday, and on Friday it occurs to them that it would be really great if they had a patio, and then you can, you know, put in for $500 to build their patio. I did a lot of little fast jobs putting in patios.
I like stuff like that's kind of like writing a novel, actually, in a way.
No, at the time, my key priority was just not to have a job that involved my brain in any way. I didn't want to prostitute any brain cells.
That's the kind of thing you say.
Thought.
What do you mean prostitute brain cells? Here's the thing. Your book, like, every page has like nine pronouncements, three of which I totally agree with, three of which I don't quite understand, but it makes me think, and then three of which I have no idea what you're talking about. Dignified people scream all the time. You say dignified people would never scream except scream in space, but dignified people scream? How can you say that? Don't you think they do?
This is a character, I have to enlighten you about the nature of fiction. I know you've read books before, but the person who says that is a fictional character I made up on a whim. And, you know, she can kind of say what she wants.
Well, you said it was turned into a tortured autobiography, so I'm just going from there, man.
Yeah, and I was kind of kidding. These things happen.
So I fell in love with Tiffany from day one, which I kind of fell in love with you at the same time. But when you said that she looked... I did. But when she said that... When you said she looked like Jane Birkin in Scandal, then I was like totally, totally smitten. And I didn't know...
Yeah, I know. There's no better way to look, except possibly for looking like Ally McGraw in Getaway.
Oh. Was that with Steve McQueen?
Yeah, yeah. But
I don't
Jane
know.
Birkin is actually cuter, except when she dances, that one scene where she has friends over to Serge Gainsbourg's apartment, and they do these really goofy hippie dances.
Well, that's because of Serge Gainsbourg. I mean, what's with him? That's the reason why the French like Jerry Lewis is like Serge Gainsbourg. Like, you know, he sings horribly. He's a terrible actor. But he marries all these beautiful women.
Right, he traumatized them. It's the compulsion to repeat a trauma, so that once you've sat through a Serge Gainsbourg movie, you want to see movies with horrible-looking guys who can't sing, and you want to see them over and over because you're reliving that trauma.
Look, it's another one of your pronouncements. That was a pronouncement.
That's a statement. What am I supposed to do? Like,
I don't know.
Speak in that special, like, I know, I could make everything into a question. You know, like when you're watching a movie with Serge Gainsbourg?
That's what I do.
And he...
That's really wimpy. You're right. I should stop doing that.
And then Jane Birkin dances.
I know.
And
it
sometimes
is.
You feel like she looks kind of cute.
So do you think, like, do you know that last line where it's, so we beat on boats against the current, born ceaselessly into the past? Because you stuck that in there.
No, seriously. I made that up. And I found out only later that F. Scott Fitzgerald had used that line before.
No, that's like George Harrison with My Sweet Lord, that he didn't know he was plagiarizing the chiffons. Who else would say that, boats against the current?
No, I think it's fair to spike things with allusions to... things everyone is intimately familiar with.
So what about
The Great Gatsby has been in the news lately, and I can almost trust like an average high school kid to pick up on it. Well, no, I said almost. I meant almost. But anyway.
So what does your uncle think so far, that I'm being mean to you or something?
I could get his opinion. Uncle Charlie, how do you think my interviewer is doing? Is he being mean to me? Yeah, my interviewer.
Well, I didn't want this long an answer.
He says that that hearing this end of the conversation by itself is what? Mind-boggling.
But your
he
whole...
says he's confused.
Your whole life
he's
is...
not confused easily.
But your whole life is mind-boggling and confusing. What does he expect? I mean, seriously.
Yeah. Uncle Charlie and I, though, he understands. We have a lot in common. We look alike. We have the same skin conditions we discovered today.
Ooh, I have skin conditions. I'm going to Florida to talk to my
plastic. Skin conditions? Which one?
Oh, I have these basal cell carcinomas because I'm old. And, you know, my mother never put sunscreen on her, damn her, on me.
Carcinoma? Man, even Uncle Charlie doesn't have carcinoma.
Yeah, but it's not really. I mean, basal cell.
Oh, he does. Do you have basal cell carcinoma? Yeah. Oh, he does too. See? We all have something in common. It's like one big happy family.
There's another pronouncement. So, yeah, put that in your book. Do we all have basal cell carcinoma?
No, you want me to be pigeonholed as a woman writer? Then make me write about cancer.
Why do you keep bringing up this woman thing? It never crosses my mind. You're the one that's being sexist, I think. Maybe not. Well, anyway, so you really...
No, my sexism is conscious and yours is unconscious. That's how it works.
You mean the way you stole... What's that?
Recently, a friend of mine who's a shaman... put himself into a trance state. I didn't have to be in a trance state for this. I just had to sort of lie down on his bed while he did things like shake rattles and chant and burn different herbs and use this strange Caribbean liquor and like spray a mist of alcohol in the room using
That's
his
dangerous.
Lips like a trumpet player. It was all very strange. And he put himself into a trance state. And in this trance state, he's able to enter the souls of other people and find out what their totem animal is. And he enters your unconscious mind and looks around, and then he very quickly usually meets an animal.
And you were wall creeper?
No.
Pigeon?
He went into my mind and began looking for the doors to my unconscious, but he couldn't find the doors. All he found, he said, I'm not making this up, was this strange party going on with these, like, scary clowns.
Ooh.
And no totem animal at all. And he after an hour, he just gave up. And when we were done, he said that I had no unconscious mind.
Well, that's good. You're integrated. That's excellent. I've only met, like, 6 people in my life who are totally integrated, including my daughter.
I doubt I'm totally integrated, but my uncle claims this explains everything.
Well, I think it explains a lot, except the clowns are so scary. Hey, he didn't burn any sage, did he? I hate sage.
I don't know what he burned. I kept my eyes closed obediently the entire time.
I had a dream one time that this old guy looked like Gandalf. He's taking me through my house, and he takes me to this room. I didn't even know. What the hell is it? I never saw this room in my house. And inside is this beautiful library with all these books bound in vellum and leather and calfskin, and they're all blue and red and emerald and whatever. And he looks at me and he goes, all this could have been yours. It's really screwed me up.
It sounds really depressing.
It's horrible.
Like someone saying you've missed opportunities to...
Yeah. Yeah, well,
burned.
I have.
Oh.
I know.
I'm sorry to hear that. How old are you?
62.
52?
62. Within
62. Six, yeah. 60.
And you were...
sorry.
And you are going to be 50, or you are...
I'm a child of 50.
Yeah, you are a child.
Yeah.
Well, so now I'm going to get away from this because it is depressing me. so you like quantum physics. So you like Heisenberg's principle of indeterminacy, and you like Schrodinger's cat, right?
I didn't say I like them.
Well, you get you get all quantum on the birds.
Yeah, but I also think that if you really want to lose some listeners, allow me to remark that I think you can arrive at that principle a priori, that you don't need physics to get to it. It's something any philosopher could tell you. Because if you define something as a quantum of information, then of course, if you measure it, that you're going to remove a quantum and you're not going to know what you originally had. It's so a priori, it's like one of Newton's thought experiments that I assume it's meaningless and an artifact of perception.
Well, then how come you say Stephen doesn't have an event horizon to go into another area of astrophysics?
I didn't say that. Yes, in my book says that.
Well,
she believes that and Stephen has an event horizon. Maybe that's what you just said.
Right, he does.
He has an interior. He has interiority that she can't get at, like a black hole.
Right.
And she likes that. She doesn't think it's interesting to know a guy who shares everything. It's just not erotic.
Just not erotics. Yes, another one. Hey, so anyway, so you realize we're talking about your book now?
In theory, we are, yes.
It's not in... not in theory. We are,
in fact, talking about my book.
Yes. You want to talk more about your book?
Whatever you want to talk about.
Okay, let's see. So I read your book, and I was really confused, and it was really confusing to me. So then I read it again, and I really...
Wow.
And it was okay, now I understand. I mean, now I understand, which was really strange. I don't usually do that. And it's easy to read your book again because your book is so short. But now you're getting famous, and you go to Amazon, and your new book, Mislaid, where you say you're getting megabucks, is already on sale at Amazon, and I pre-ordered it, but I won't get it until May.
Yeah, I heard when I was in San Francisco at a bookstore, my Harper editor, well, it's Echo Press, and they're pretty happy about this. I mean, initially when HarperCollins, when Echo Press bought this novel, Mislaid, which I wrote in 2013, The Wall Creeper I wrote in 2011, and I sold it in 2012. And the Mislaid I wrote in 2013 and sold in 2014. And the difference in the advances is a factor of 666.
Eek.
Just for the record.
That's pretty cool.
I got 666 times as much money for Mislaid.
You're a gazillionaire.
No, I'm not, because the advance for The Wall Creeper is smaller than you would dream possible. In any case, really, seriously, it's not a whole lot of money, but for me it's a lot of money, because I live on, 10 or 11,000 euros a year, which is, maybe $14,000, and I live well on that in Germany, because it's a place with, high-value public space, and you don't have to spend a lot of money to have fun. So we sort of expected, you're not really supposed to compete with your big-ticket novel, and usually they even put a clause in your contract saying you will publish no other novel within a year or 2 years of this novel. And I said, well, people, we have a problem, because I'm definitely publishing a novel in October. And they said, well, who cares? It'll be so completely under the radar. It's so weird. It's so short.
Oh, no. You're going to win the National Book Award, and then you're going to get a really big head.
It's such a tiny micro press. It might as well be called, Dorothea Publishing Hobby. And so if they listen to this podcast, they're going to come here and wring my neck.
I know.
Come all the way to L.A. and wring my neck for saying that. But, okay, I didn't mean it. It's Dorothea Publishing Project, and they do two fabulous books every year, and it amazes me how good some of the stuff is.
I know. I agree.
It's astounding.
I agree.
It's a book that's coming out in parallel with mine, Dan. These are people doing something very different from what I try to do, because I like exploiting the trappings of realism. And most of their other writers are people who are experimenting on sort of a word and sentence level with playing with people's perceptions and, you know, screwing with their minds. And Amina Kane and Renee Gladman are doing something, and Azarine van der Vliet Olumi, who wrote Frak Healer, which I think is really good. They don't write like I do at all, but it's sort of equally experimental in a completely different way.
Is that a bird?
No, this is a clock hanging on the wall at my uncle's house. That was the Baltimore Orioles, signifying that it's now 11 o'clock in L.A.
So it is.
Yeah.
Well, I've never read anything like what you've written. I mean, it reminds me, maybe unfortunately for you, the way I write, but it's... You know, I mean, you could say it's a novel about eco-terrorism or about birds or about...
There is no eco-terrorism in there, man.
Well, I'm just thinking about reviews that I've read, that's all. I agree, there isn't.
Keith Gessen said that in his blurb. And that everybody...
Well, yeah, put it on the back of the book.
And calls it eco-terrorist. And I'm thinking... So the other day I was flying to get here to L.A., and I step up in front of the TSA guys, and he says... He looks at my passport, runs it through a machine, and says, "Hello, if you'd like to step aside, we have you qualify for a special pre-check program." And I thought, "Oh, they're going to strip search me now because I've been associated with terrorism and all these newspaper articles." But no, I was actually in the pre-check program, and they didn't even make me take off my shoes.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I'm flying out.
Yeah, I was astounded.
I'm flying tomorrow, and I'm TSA pre-check. It's so nice. I feel so superior to everyone.
Yeah, well, for what it's worth, after I got pre-check, Jonathan Franzen told me the next flight he took, he wasn't pre-check anymore. They made him take off his belt and take out his laptop and go through the regular line.
Yes, and then so, you feel plebeian again.
We don't know what's going on here.
So what did you do?
TSA is out of control.
What did you do in Philadelphia? And you talk about Temple University, which is, you know, right down the street, basically.
I lived for a while in West Philly. Just moved there from New York, and I tried to write some when I was there. I got sort of mixed up with the anarchist community in West Philly. I lived over the A space for a while. But it wasn't a long time that I was in Philly.
No, 2 years.
Yeah, like 2 years. Then an article appeared about me in the Philly paper, not the Inquirer, but the other one, the one for, like, Flyers fans. I forget what it's called.
Oh, the Daily News.
The Daily News, right, on New Year's Eve. And I got a lot of... my email address was in it, and I got a lot of fan mail. There was sort of a cute picture, too, and I... So I got a lot of fan mail, and I ended up kind of... marrying one of the people who wrote me one of these letters. He's a poet. What can I say?
You kind of married him? Just like Stephen and Tiffany?
Yeah, we kind of got married. You know how that happens.
Yeah, well, that's exactly your book. Once again, it is autobiographical. It's your entire life. And if you're picking up rocks in order to get rid of a dam and throwing them in the water, that is kind of eco-terrorism, actually, I hate to tell you.
Well, but she does it to flood a riparian forest. That's her aim. And I think if you're trying to save the lives of some oak trees, to call this terrorism stretches our conception of terrorism.
Well, the United States constantly stretches the definition of terrorism because there really isn't any. But, yeah, you're right. It does.
Yeah, I mean, she doesn't want, she certainly doesn't want anyone to get hurt. And in the book, which sort of, abuses the geography of the River Elbe and puts the this village of Breitenhagen sort of in the wrong place, on the wrong shore of the river, with a low side of the river next to it, and so on. It's changed from the way it really is. So it was sort of distressing to me when last year in 2013, after I had already sold the book and it was, you know, typeset and going to be printed, and there really was massive flooding along the Elbe, and a real village, Breitenhagen, was underwater for a long time, and it was very, very expensive, and people were very, very upset. And then there was a confession given to the media by a group claiming to be eco-terrorists. So I wrote to Dorothea Publishing Project saying, you know, maybe we should change the name of this village. because it sounds like I gave them the idea or I'm connected with it somehow. But no one, they certainly didn't care, and I'm not sure anyone else cares, because it's just, you know, it's publicity, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, and that's interesting that you're now out, and, you know, you're a real author out in the open, and we talked about this a little bit before we started about, I liked it when you were mysterious, and now you're no longer mysterious. You're like a regular person, right?
Should I be more mysterious? I can try.
Well, no, you're screwed now. I mean, I don't know how you could go back underground. Hey, do you know that palindrome called?
How far underground was I, for crying out loud?
Because everything says
there was a profile of me in the Philly paper.
Yeah, I know, but you wrote novels to one person. I mean, I read these things. You wrote novels to one person because that was the one person you wanted to read.
Yeah, it's true.
Who is Nell?
Well, that's pretty far underground.
Well, and the thing, who is Nell Zink? That's what the back of the book says. So, you know, it's kind of.
I mean, if Keith could read Hebrew, he'd know who I am, because I've been in all the major Hebrew literary magazines. My friend Avner Schatz and my ex-husband, Zohar Eitan, routinely translate my pieces, and they have appeared in literary magazines as prominent as Orot, Mazmerim, and the other one, Helikon. So I'm not a nobody at all.
I didn't say you were
a
nobody.
I'm huge in Israel, just completely huge.
Well, you misinterpret me. I never said you were a nobody. I said you were mysterious, gosh. And also, do you know that palindrome, Napoleon's Lament, Abel was I ere I saw Elba?
Yeah.
Okay. I just thought I'd throw that out. And I like the way you say the price of tea in China.
Yeah, I tried to get a lot of obscure American idioms into this book and put them all into the mouth of Stephen.
Who calls you I'm sorry, I don't mean you. Someone calls somebody a dingbat, and I call everybody a nitwit, and now I have lots of people saying nitwit because it's one of my favorite words. Dingbat is good too, though.
Nitwit sounds to me a little more critical. It sounds more like you're calling someone stupid, whereas dingbat is sort of like being a little flaky or spacey.
Yeah, nitwit
I think nitwit is more negative.
It's more negative, but it's better.
I think you should switch.
No, dingbat is kind of,
I start calling
like
people dingbats.
Nitwit is more literary, I think.
In the sense of sounding more Victorian.
Yeah, it's older. Dingbat is like Archie Bunker.
I think it was Meathead on Archie Bunker. Or was it? No. Oh, Meathead was the son-in-law on Archie Bunker, and Dingbat was his wife or something. That's not very nice.
Well, he called his wife Dingbat, but I think he called, be that as it may.
So, yes, we do not want to set a precedent for comparing me with Archie Bunker.
No,
possibly help.
Let's move away from that. So
my uncle is laughing.
So here's your characters. There's Tiffany, who's the protagonist. There's Stephen, who's her husband, who has all kinds of things happen to him. There's Elvis, her lover, because they have a marriage where they can pretty much have sex with whoever they want.
She doesn't get Stephen's permission.
No, but he doesn't seem to mind.
Does it? These things happen.
Well, see, he's in bed with her sister. Is that a spoiler?
I don't think so.
Okay. Yeah.
I think the more you imply that there's a lot of sex in the book, the better off I am.
Well, yeah, in the first three pages.
I mean, you could just talk about anybody with anybody on the show. And
Well, the first five pages are incredibly great. They're so great. And there's some weird sex in there, so you can't talk about it on the air, so don't even start. And and I assume
there is nothing weird about it. It just happens to be that in my experience, to get that honest description of a certain activity, there are two places you can read. One is my book, and the other is a pre-1990 Joy of Gay Sex. Those are the only places where this is discussed openly.
Henry Miller discusses it page after page, so I have to disagree.
No, I mean...
Oh, you mean as eloquently as you did it?
No, I mean her comparison of what it feels like. Her refusal to adopt what many have called the male gaze, which is the male perspective. But we can't go into it, so we won't.
Okay. No, I forgot what I was going to ask you. Oh, yeah, so Stephen, and then there's Elvis, and then there's Rudolph, who's another essential protagonist because...
Yes, he's a bird, though.
Yes. Oh, all right. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about your book? I'm supposed to say at the beginning. I forgot.
I think it's too late for that. I think you have to go on to your next question.
All right. My next question is, well, it's not a question, but I went to Barcelona a couple weeks ago and I ate this restaurant called Cinc Sentits. And I can't even tell you anything about the food, but it was the most extraordinary dining experience I've had in my life. Because every course they gave you took you someplace. It took you either to a brown, sad place. I went with my nephew. I'm his uncle, like your uncle is your uncle. And anyway, so your mood would go up and down, and you could kind of follow exactly where you were going because whoever was making the food was taking you there. And that reminded me of your novel. It's not so much what's happening to the people, it's what's happening to you because you're reading it. And I always think that's such a cool thing because before, when you were writing it to one person, that's one thing. Now you're writing it for everybody, but you've given this, you know, child, baby, son, daughter to everybody. And now it's my job, I assume it's my job, to figure out what you mean. And what I found really amazing about your book is it made me feel certain ways. The questions that I'm being totally incoherent, but what I'm saying is
it makes sense to me what you're saying, and I'm very flattered by it because that's something I try to do, to be manipulative in a certain way by talking about one thing while sort of between the lines talking about something else, by distracting people with a superficial topic so I can sneak in something else. And that's, I think that creates emotional tension as you're reading it. I try to do that, and if you say that it's working, I'm very pleased. But you shouldn't forget, as you originally said, The Wall Creeper is not a book that I wrote for everybody. Mislaid, the book that's coming out in May, was consciously written with the aim of being published and being read by as many people as possible. And you can see a dramatic difference in how it's written.
Yeah, but since it's
Whereas
called...
this book, The Wall Creeper, was written initially just for the amusement of one person so that it was very much attuned to what I knew of his reading comprehension level.
I think that's so cool that you do that. But I also think that because the title of your new book is Mislaid, that there's going to be a whole bunch of deviant sex in it too, right?
Oh, you bet your buttons. No, it's not terribly explicit.
But it's mislaid. I mean, I assume that's...
Yeah. But if you want the really heavy pornographic stuff, you're going to have to buy The Wall Creeper.
You're going to win the National Book Award, so you shouldn't really diss it like this. I mean,
And I know, people keep telling me I make out like the book isn't very good, and I'm like, well, they don't need me to tell me it's good. They have the New York Times to tell them it's good. I'm the author. You know, my job is to know its secret flaws.
Well, look, let's look at it this way. Have you optioned it yet to any film studio? I'm sure you have.
Well, the truth is, Brad Pitt's production company called up my agent, I think when they read that it had eco-terrorism in it, and demanded to see it.
Well,
but then a couple weeks later, they said it wasn't a film.
I was going to ask you whether this is the kind of book. This is the kind of book that Martin Scorsese would say it's unfilmable. But I think it's filmable. And look, you turn it in. Well, I can't. This is like a spoiler.
They made a film out of Swan's Way. You know, they can film anything if they put their minds to it.
Yeah, but look at Winter's Tale by Mark Halperin. The book was wonderful, and then they made a horrible, horrible movie out of it that just sank.
Oh, I don't know it.
You should read Winter's Tale by Mark Halperin. It's a great book.
Yeah.
And you should read The Bone Clocks and by David Mitchell, and you should read The Light We Cannot
See. Yeah, I've
heard
The Bone Clocks is good.
The Bone Clocks is great, and Cloud Atlas was great. He's a great guy, too. I just interviewed him.
Well, my informant, John Clute, what he said was The Bone Clocks was great, but he wasn't sure it was good yet. You know, a good book is good.
Yeah.
Something can be incredibly brilliant and great, but in the end, it's not a good book.
Yeah, we actually talked about that. He was such a very nice person. Not that you're not. Hmm? What?
John Clute?
No,
David Mitchell. Yeah.
He was really nice. So, like, if you were writing, like, if suppose you said, well, suppose I wrote, George and Martha were driving to Barcelona in a smart car, and the traffic was horrible. They wasted 5 hours. And then when they arrive at their hotel, George says, "At last." And Martha sighs and moans and says, "There was so much traffic." So, could you write that paragraph? And it would mean something else?
You mean by introducing subliminal,
sociological,
and critical material into every word?
Yeah, I mean,
I suppose I could, but it would take me a little time because I wouldn't be making it up off the top of my head. It would be sort of an assignment. I can't do it on the fly.
Do you make it? What do you do? How do you do all these things? Do you sit down? Do you say, I'm going to write a book about this? Do you just keep writing and then do you do a bunch of drafts and go back and change it all? What do you do?
Usually what happens is because of the job I had translating, I would have just downtime when I didn't have a job. And almost everything I've done so far for many years now has been done in these 3 week spates where I sit down and for 3 weeks I do almost nothing but write, or I do almost nothing but revise. But 3 weeks is sort of how long I can concentrate somehow. And like when I tried to write Mislaid, I thought, I'm going to make this novel really long. It's going to have 100,000 words and I'm going to spend a whole month. But after 3 weeks, I stopped and just finished it. Just said, okay, it ends here. And then later I went back and added a bunch. I took out a bunch, but always in these 3 week sessions. So I guess that's like, you know, some people can run 8 miles or run a marathon, and I can write for 3 weeks.
But you can't. I mean, are you saying you wrote the whole book in 3 weeks?
Well, I did the first draft in 3 weeks.
Well, then I interviewed all these authors who say it's taken me 4 years or 14 years to write these books.
They're weirdos.
Yeah, I know.
No. They're not weirdos. They're probably just people who have a different kind of job. I know so many people who write and also have a full-time job and like 2 kids. And I know for a fact, I'm a weak person. If I had a full-time job and 2 kids, I wouldn't write a word. When I had a full-time job, I would write about a short story every 3 months. I can't imagine writing a novel if I had a job.
I've interviewed lots of people where I can hear their kids crying in the background. And I always say to them, when do you write? He goes, and this was Charlie Yu. He wrote How to Live Safely in a Science Fictional Universe. And he says, I just, you know, wake up at 12 o'clock at night and I write till 3 o'clock in the morning. And in the morning I go back to my job as a lawyer for some internet firm, you know?
Yeah, I don't know how old he is. Like
he's young.
Avner Schatz published a wonderful novel like 15 years ago, Sailing Towards the Sunset. But he was young when he wrote it. He was working full-time, but he would do things like just run off and hole himself up somewhere and write for 2 weeks solid, barely sleeping, or, you know, revise all night and then go to work in the morning. That's an awful lot to ask.
I should never have told you about my dream. Now I'm all depressed.
Wait, the dream where...
About the guy who said, yeah, you could have had all these. My books.
Well, you're only 62.
You're only 50.
Right. I mean, if I can...
Yeah, I know.
...publish your first novel at 50, then presumably, I wouldn't say anything is possible. Anything is possible if you are straight edge. It's that simple.
Yeah, I'm not that.
I mean, most people, they get in the habit when they're young. When you're a young man and strong and healthy, it really helps to make yourself a little bit ill. So you drink alcohol and you smoke cigarettes, so you kind of feel sick in the morning so you can go to school and sit there all day. But people retain these habits until they're 50, 60 years old, and they start to look a little peaked and kind of green around the edges. And if you give that stuff up, you can start looking 10 years younger after about 3 weeks. That's my advice.
It's the same time it takes to write a novel.
You know, stop drinking, stop smoking, you'll be 40 by, like, New Year's.
I fell asleep at my desk in high school and used to drool. And then one time I had this dream that was like an electric dream of John Lennon coming and talking to me, but he gave me an electric shock. And then I fell out of my chair onto the floor.
And you remember this dream you had in high school and it still means a lot to you?
John Lennon means a lot to me.
Oh.
Well, yeah, it does mean a lot to me. But anyway.
You're okay. Worrying me now.
I'm not anywhere near you. I can't do anything. I mean, I'm not like a terrorist.
No, I mean, it's... You sound like a frustrated writer.
I am a frustrated writer. I've been a frustrated writer since I was like 16. But it's like you're making me feel even worse. I asked my literature professor when I was 18, I said, how do you go about writing a novel? He goes, well, if you have to ask, you can't. And he was right. Oh, I feel horrible. God.
That's not true.
I wish I had a therapist. I mean, I have one, but...
Believe me, when I write my books, I don't think they're any good.
It's so nice of you to try to be nice to me.
Make
me feel better.
I mean, I'm not allowed to say this to anybody, but I thought The Wall Creeper was completely unpublishable crap, and that's why I submitted it to Dorothy, a publishing project, instead of, like, trying to give it to an agent. I mean, I had Jonathan Franzen trying to sell my other novel. I could have, if I thought The Wallkeeper was any good, I could have made him give it to Susan Golem. But I thought it was garbage.
Well, it's like a Confederacy of Dunces, one of my favorite books in the world.
Maybe you're a better writer than you think you are.
I'm a really good writer.
Yeah, see?
Yeah. Yeah, well, look, you were a really good writer, and you didn't publish anything. I write stuff, and I don't publish it.
Well, do you let anybody read it?
Yeah, but I have this tendency to do.
Did they say it's any good?
Oh yeah.
Maybe it is bad. I mean, that's another possibility.
No, everyone likes it. Everyone says I should be a writer. I think it's like right before I die.
What's the weak link?
There's some kind of emptiness in the center of my psyche. Why am I saying this on the air? But you're saying a lot of stuff you shouldn't say.
I always thought that, too. There's a beautiful poem by Luis Cernuda. Adolescente fui en días idénticos a nubes, cosa grácil, visible por penumbre y reflejo. Extraño es si ese recuerdo busco que tanto, tanto duela sobre el cuerpo de hoy. Perder placer es triste como la dulce lámpara en el lento nocturno. Anyway, he goes on to say, cuando la muerte quiera una verdad quitar de entre mis manos, las hallará vacías, como en la adolescencia, ardientes de deseo, tendidas hacia el aire. Which means, when death comes to find a truth, to take from my hands, it will find them empty, reaching for the sky, filled with yearning. And when I was young, that's how I felt. I thought, this poem expresses everything worth expressing about life, this emptiness and yearning and longing for something that just will never be there. But then I figured out, no, I exist. It's a distressing discovery. But when you find out that, when you just notice or accept that there's this kernel of, in my case, nullness, that I can't get rid of. You know, even if I fall on my head and black out, I keep making these same unfunny jokes. Oh, I can't say unfunny either, but you know what I mean. My book's hilarious. I swear to God, I can't read it without cracking up.
That's what everyone says. And I did.
But you have to accept that there's a kernel of... Now I've forgotten your name.
Sam.
Stan?
No, I would hate to have the name Stan.
What's your name?
Sam.
Sam. There's like, Samness. There's essential Samness. It is completely unique. There's 7 billion people, and none of the rest of them have Samness. And unless you write down that Samness, it's going to be lost.
Yeah, someone asked me what my day was like yesterday, and I said it was just another of the thousands of Sam days that I've had.
Well, nobody else has Sam days.
Right.
So they're valuable.
I know. Well, here's the way I look at it. You know, when Jesus was on the cross and he had one thief on either side, and the one thief is going like, you know, I don't believe any of the stuff you're saying, and it's ridiculous. And the other thief is saying, you know, I repent, and I'd like to follow you. And he says, in 1 hour, I'll see you in heaven. So I figure, like, at the very end, like, you know, at the very end, I'll just repent, and then I'll go to heaven. But I might just have to wait till the very end.
Repent of what?
Whatever. I don't know. I don't know, actually.
You know, I think you have a core of guilt, maybe.
I'm Jewish.
It doesn't have to do with being Jewish.
It does.
No. Catholic people are even guiltier.
That's true. They have original sin.
They have original sin. But it mostly has to do with not having experienced the unconditional love of whomever.
Well, my mother just got her driver's license, though.
Oh, you mean she couldn't drive you anywhere when you were small, and this was a trauma that stayed with you?
Oh, no, wait a minute. No, you misunderstand. She's always had a driver's license. But at 92, they still gave her driver's license because she's in such good
shape. Oh, I thought you meant she just learned to drive.
No. She's had it all her life. I just thought my brother just sent me an image of it, and I said, just like before this interview, and I'm thinking, wow, Mom got her driver's license renewed at 92 because she's in such great shape. You know, and I always say to her, you know, just hang it up. I mean, there's not going to be much more happening. And I've been waiting, you know, for a long time. Just whenever I take her a picture, I always tell her to step back further when we're like at a precipice or a lake or something like that. So the thing is that both of us laugh, and I think as long as the two of us can laugh at death, she'll never die. So that's why I do it.
I don't want to say that I'm not sure that method works, but...
I think it works.
Yeah, I think we should change the subject, because any mention of death will move your listeners politically to the right. This has been proven again and again by social psychologists, and I'm not in the business of moving people to the right.
I wonder if anyone's listening to this, but they will listen to it on the iTunes, and they'll listen to it on YouTube.
I shudder to think.
I know. It's going to be horrible for you.
Well, do you think I've become more mysterious or less mysterious in the course of this interview?
Oh, well, that one blogger says how Jonathan Franzen was looking on bemused but happy when you were going off in some kind of lyrical but strange way of talking at some reading. But
yeah, a friend of mine called me called him my straight man when I had to do another reading a couple days later in San Francisco, because the reading with Franzen was in New York, and then he interviewed me afterwards. And a couple days later, I had a reading in San Francisco, and it also got good press, and my friend said, I'm glad you can survive without your straight man.
You and he
really was almost like a comedy routine, because I knew it sort of freed me from the necessity of mentioning Franzen, for example, the fact that he was sitting right there.
Yeah, and the two of you seem like complete polar opposites. I mean, from reading his stuff and then reading yours.
Well, I think that's because people don't appreciate how much he's an artist rather than some kind of blogger. I mean, he, for example,
yeah,
He doesn't have open relationships in his novels. Why? Because they have less dramatic potential than relationships that are supposed to be closed and faithful. And it's quite true.
Well,
you have more potential drama if when a wife is unfaithful, her husband's going to change the locks.
Well, it sounds like your book.
So it's art. He's doing it. He's trying to observe the culture as it's practiced by most people and tease the most dramatic situations out of what he sees. It's a different kind of realism. And we both just use trappings of realism to cover something that, in essence, is very abstract.
So, after you got divorced from the poet, did you get remarried?
No, I'm single.
Do you think we could get married?
What?
Do you think maybe we could get married, possibly?
Definitely not. I will never get married again.
Either way.
I think it's silly.
So do I. I never understood
people, the reason. People fall in love, and the first thing they do is they want to run to the state, of all people, and say, oh, by the way, we're sleeping together. Hello, government. I want you to know who I'm having sex with. Like, what are they thinking? It's so crazy.
I don't know. And
it's like they get upset about being spied on, and then they get married.
Can we just go out?
I don't live in Philly.
I know. I'd come to where
but
you are.
Next time I'm in Philly, we'll have coffee, as the saying goes. No, but it really will just be coffee, because my private life is mysterious and will remain mysterious.
That's good. We have to end it with that, I think, because I've gone over, like, I don't know what they're going to do. I guess they're just going to edit this down because I only have 43 minutes, but then I can put the whole thing on the web.
But oh, no. Just cut out the boring parts.
None of it was boring to me.
You seem to have a very high tolerance, so. But thank you for being so tolerant.
And thank you for being so tolerant.
You're welcome.
Okay, so maybe we'll talk again sometime in life.
All right. Well, I hope you have a nice day. I didn't want to say nice life.
I know, because I just said
we were talking about your expectation of suddenly repenting at the age of 94 just before you jump off a cliff and finally writing your novel while you're falling.
I could do that. like people relive their lives when they're falling. Well, anyway, so you have a nice day, and I hope your uncle has a nice day, too.
We all will. It will be. It's L.A.
Okay.
The weather is gorgeous.
Okay. I hope I see you or talk to you sometime.
All right. Talk to you later.
All right. See ya.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay. Well, that was very strange. And I made it strange. But she's a wonderful writer. The Wall Creeper is a wonderful, wonderful book. And I went way over, so you won't hear some of this. But next week we'll have another great author, I think Johannes Skibsrud, Mandy Aftel, and Asaf Gavron, whose names are unpronounceable. And for a complete schedule, visit us at wellingtonsquarebooks.com or WCHE1520.com or simply download our podcast at iTunes or Podomatic. Okay, so you won't hear a lot of this because it'll be edited out. Anyway, thanks for joining us as always, and we'll talk to you soon.
You've been listening to the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will be back next week with reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today.